The views and opinions expressed on this show or any other show on Hermco Radio Network are not necessarily those reflective of Hermco Radio owners, affiliates, or local sponsors. Any hurt feelings or mixed emotions infringing upon the PC movement should be referred to Hermco's Human Services Department, which can be reached at blah, 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 to which time you will be told to shut. On behalf of Hermco Radio Network, I would like to take this time now to thank you from the bottom of our blackened souls. Thank you!
Ah, it is so good to see you again, sir. I see you have brought your friends with you this time. Very good, sir. Would you like your usual table? Right this way then, sir. Please follow me.
Who are we kidding? We're not that stuffy.
I knew I was being threatened. Do you think it's worth holding out? I mean, I've heard some pretty ugly things about those guys. Ugly stories.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for Politics Cafe, where we sit down and discuss anything and everything. No holds barred. Bring any topic to the table. We don't care. We'll discuss it. Come on in. Sit down. Take a load off. Now, the host of the show, Mark.
There we go. We found a button again. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and fellow conversationalists around the world, and welcome once again to the Politics Cafe, www.herncode.com, the best in internet talk radio. The Politics Cafe is a small cafe located on an isolated stretch of the information superhighway, where we get together once a week and grill up some fresh topics for your digestion. And yes, as the election season grows near, we have got a few fresh topics. No doubt about it, the mudslinging has begun. And we got a terrorism alert coming out of Europe, which we're going to get into here tonight, and for good reason, actually. All kinds of stuff. But I got to get into the mudslinging a little bit here tonight. This is, and where do I got it here? Now, folks, I know you've heard about Christine O'Donnell, who is from Delaware, plotting it. And according to this, she's plotting to take over. Now, this is actually the AP doing their damnedest to try to sling mud. And she's looking pretty strong, actually, and it's not going to work. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at this article and you read between the lines here, you're going to understand that Christine O'Donnell might be exactly who you want to be on your senator from Delaware. I'll tell you what, if I was living in Delaware, I would be voting for this woman, probably because of what this article says. But anyway, we'll get into this by Ben Evans off the Associated Press. And as always, all articles read on this program are for informational, educational, and discussion purposes only. And don't bother trying to sue me there, folks. It doesn't work. Can't get blood from a turnip. You know how the saying goes. Hey, Natalie, how you doing there tonight? Glad to see you. All right, Republican Senate nominee Christine O'Donnell of Delaware said in a 2006 debate, they had to go back, 4 years to dig this up, that China was plotting to take over America and claimed to have classified information about the country that she could not divulge. Now, O'Donnell's comments came as she and two other Republican candidates debated U.S. policy on China during Delaware's 2006 Senate primary, which O'Donnell ultimately lost. She said China had a carefully thought out and strategic plan to take over America and accused one opponent of appeasement for suggesting that the two countries were economically dependent and should find a way to be allies. That doesn't work, she said. There's much I want to say. I wish I wasn't privy to some of the classified information that I am privy to. A country that forces women to have abortions and mandates that you can only have one child and will not allow you the freedom to read the Bible. You think they can be our friend? She asked. We have to look at our history and realize that if they pretend to be our friend, it's because they've got something up their sleeve. Now, O'Donnell's campaign didn't respond today to requests for a comment. Good for them. At the debate, opponent Jan Ting countered that China has the potential to become a more democratic country and an important ally. And of course, now this obviously pointed right at the Democrats here, folks. You gotta love this. I think our China policy has to be handled very carefully, Ting said. We have the capability of making an enemy or a friend out of China. Now, when Ting challenged O'Donnell's claim about having secret information, O'Donnell didn't answer specifically, but suggested she had received it through nonprofit groups she worked with that frequently sent missionaries there. Now, that, my friends, is worth its weight in gold. Okay? People who are on the inside in China and who can tell you things about what's going on in China are obviously valuable, and if you are in contact with missionaries and whatnot. And look, let's face it, okay? Religion, banned by communism. Banned by communism everywhere. All right, very, very hard time holding any sort of religion. Okay? Missionaries, I am assuming, are referring to religious people. So Christ only knows what kind of resistance they ran into performing missionary work in China, you know, what have you. But the fact of the matter is, you know, this is nothing more than mudslinging. Make no mistake about this, all right? And I'm gonna have to back up Christine on what she's saying here. The Chinese are a huge, huge, huge collectivist nation. Now, they're one of the few collectivist nations in history. And there have been quite a few of them. I'm referring right back to the 20th century here when you've had the fascists in Italy and Germany, the communists in Russia, and, you know, all of the Soviet Union and what have you. And, of course, China. Now, and one thing the long-time listeners to this program have often heard me comment on is the fact that collectivist countries generally dry up their resources pretty damn quick on a PDQ basis. Make no mistake about it. Their biggest resource being humans, you know, being humans with common sense and the means and capability to get the hell out of there. You know, and they are generally, they run out of the human resource pretty damn quick. And it's a problem for them. Well, not to speak of all the other resources that go, food, whatnot, what have you. You know, I mean, history shows what happened to back in the Ukraine during communist times. History shows what happened during Adolf Hitler's time. You know, when they started to run low on the resources that they needed, their next step was always, and in the past, and it always will be in the future, spread beyond your borders. You have got to go out, get out beyond your borders to get what you need. You've got to get more. That's why the Soviet Union expanded the way it did. It's why Hitler marched into Czechoslovakia, marched into Poland, marched into France. All right? It's why the communists in China managed to go on, take over Korea, took over all of the Southeast, well, not all of Southeast Asia, but moved in through Vietnam, through South Vietnam, you know, through many, many different places. This is all part of the MO of collectivism everywhere. It has always been that way. China is still a collectivist nation. Now, one of the things you got to give them credit for is the fact that they are, managing now, knowing full well that they can't expand their borders any further. Hey, the earth has only been so big. They've managed to supply the things that they need, you know, which has been, more than anything else, the human resource, intelligence, economic ways and means, you know, a ways and means, let's face it, I mean, you know, before the Soviet Union opened up its doors, you know, to Richard Nixon way back when, economically, they were still back in the 18th century, totally, you know, they were still basically a subsistence agricultural country. Very, very little manufacturing, very little in the electronics, very little in any progress as far as the humanities concerned at all. You know, a technological process, I think, or progress is the word I'm looking for here. Now, they've managed to co-opt this from several nations around the world and found out that trade is the way to do it. They've also adopted some forms of capitalism, figuring that out well. And one of the things that I've always said here, too, in the past, is the Chinese, okay, who are the inventors of paper money, or another one's there. They understand paper money. They understand debt. Okay, they understand trade, and they understand the balance of trade. Now, the Chinese were buying up our bonds for lots and lots of reasons. Of course, number one reason, obviously, to make money. You know, why does anybody go out and buy a bond? Because over the long time, they want to make some money. It's a capitalist instrument. You know, you spend X amount of dollars, and you're expecting over a period of time to get X plus Y back. I mean, let's face it, you expect to get a return on your investment. pretty smart, pretty strategic move on their part. But what is it they're going to expect to get back? Now, we've noticed that, you know, they have slowed down their buying. I wouldn't say that they have stopped altogether, although there were a lot of reports out there, you know, sometime a year or two ago where the Chinese just refused to buy our bonds. You know, they obviously laughed at Timothy Geithner when he went over there and spoke to their college students about how sound the American economic and business model is out here. The Chinese all laughed at him. They knew better. I mean, these are people that have been engaging in economics and have, you know, like I said, have been using paper money for well over 1,000 years. But the fact of the matter is, it could well be that they've got something up their sleeve that nobody knows about. And it could well be that this woman has got some ideas for things that she's hearing from these missionaries. But the one thing that you got to look at here, whether she's got any pertinent information to any sort of real takeovers or anything like that, isn't as important as the fact that she is at least wary of them. Now that, my friends, I think bears a lot to be said. The fact that she is looking at them, understanding that this is not a country that embraces liberty. This is not a country that embraces all of the freedoms that we have here. You know, look at all of our Bill of Rights. You know, there's no Bill of Rights in China. You know, you don't have freedom of speech over there. There's no freedom of the press. There's no freedom to own weapons. There's none of that. You know, what you have in China is a totalitarian state. It's a collectivist state by despots. It's that simple. You can't make it any more plain than that. You know? And it is something that it is a liberty, as a people who embrace liberty and who are nowhere near as large as China and who are much more productive, much more bountiful in our production than the Chinese. Yeah, well, let's face it, baby. You are going to be envied by the collectivists of the world. Somehow or another, they're going to want to co-opt what you have. Now, so far, they've been engaging in some form of trade. Would I call it fair trade? Hell no. You know, fair trade is something that works in both directions. Should, you know, the Chinese ever actually open their doors and say, yeah, bring it on in, whatever you got, well, then maybe we can call it fair trade. But as long as they're going to restrict the, you know, American manufacturers to certain products over there, certain things that they feel that they need, you know, they feel that they can use, and blah, 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 well, then okay. You know, let's not even begin to think of calling it fair trade. So I think O'Donnell's down, heading down the right path here. And I believe that at least as long as she is wary, then it's a good thing. That's what we need. We need that kind of skepticism in Congress here. And I love it. So good luck with you, Christine O'Donnell. I hope it's working out. All right, now, upwards and onwards. Now the terrorist threat that we heard about a little bit around the news today. I got one analysis that came down here on Reuters today. And out of all of the ones that I've read about it, I think this one here probably bears the most, at least to me, seems the most incredible one. This is by William McLean, a security correspondent. I don't know where William McLean comes from, but, well, actually, this is out of London, off of Reuters. It's U.S. and British alerts about possible attacks in Europe highlight concern that growing numbers of militants are going from the West to remote war zones for training in answer to Al-Qaeda's online call for violence. Now, the immediate trigger for Sunday's travel alerts was intelligence about a plot against European targets reportedly originating with a group of individuals in mountainous northern Pakistan, some of them believed to be European citizens. And I have another article here to go along with this. Few details of the conspiracy are known, but the plot appears to be of the kind that Western officials believe poses the most significant danger today. The use of so-called self-radicalized militants with no previous records of extremism. And that bears something to be thought about here, and I will talk about it a little bit. Al-Qaeda's leadership, increasingly restrained by missile strikes from U.S. drones in northwest Pakistan, prizes such homegrown recruits as they have Western passports and can travel overseas easily, experts say. Now, some experts suspect the flows to countries like Pakistan and Yemen of would-be militants have risen especially in the past 2 years, despite stepped-up efforts by some Western governments to counter Islamist radicalization among Muslim minority communities. It's a serious phenomenon in Europe, especially in Britain and Germany, said Edward Bakker, a security and conflict expert at the Netherlands Institute of International Relations. The motivation is not always simply Islamic extremism. Sometimes individuals also go to find a sense of purpose for themselves or for excitement. Now, Pakistani intelligence officials said said a suspected U.S. drone strike killed 8 militants of German nationality in northwest Pakistan on Monday. Two missiles from a suspected CIA pilotless aircraft struck a mosque in Morali in northern Waziristan. The strike came a day after the U.S. State Department issued an alert warning American citizens to exercise caution while traveling in Europe. Britain raised a from general for its citizens traveling to Germany and France. The plot that triggered the alerts involved al-Qaeda and allied militants, possibly including European citizens or residents, intelligence sources said last week. They said the militants were plotting coordinated attacks on European cities. The use of Western-based militants radicalized in online chat rooms or through email contacts with hardline preachers has grown sharply in the last 2 years. Among the most dramatic of the mostly failed attacks and plots in the West was the failed bombing of New York Times Square by Pakistani-born U.S. citizen Faisal Shahzad on May the 1st. Now, Germany's BKA Federal Crime Office said last month that more than 400 Islamic radicals were living in Germany, some of whom had been trained in camps overseas, including a hardcore with combat experience in Afghanistan. Police had seen a rise in German residents visiting the camps. European Union counterterrorism coordinator Gilles de Kerchove told Reuters on Friday the plot showed the continent had to do more to impede extremists going overseas to train. There's a number, a not insignificant number, of seriously dangerous people going around, he said. For some time, there has been serious concern about people born or resident into jihadi contacts, Somalia, and Yemen. In a report to EU member governments in June, Kerchove said al-Qaeda remained the EU's biggest threat and urged better control of the movements of potential terrorists in the EU. In Britain, Jonathan Evans, head of the MI5 Security Service, said last month there was a serious risk of lethal attacks and militants in Yemen and Somalia were growing threats. Many of the militants who travel out to Pakistan, often Europeans of South Asian, Arab, or Turkish ancestry, intend to go over the border to Afghanistan and fight Western forces there. But al-Qaeda has frequently sought to persuade them to go back home and attack Western targets there, experts say. Now, these efforts have had some success. Paul Cruikshank, an alumni fellow at the Center of Law and Security at New York University School of Law, said in a report that in a majority of 21 serious militant plots against the West since 2004, plotters either received direction from or trained with al-Qaeda or its allies in Pakistan. Between 100 and 150 Westerners were suspected of going to the region for armed training last year, a study reported Western counterterrorism officials as saying. Some of those who travel are struggling novices who view the trips as rites of passage, said an October 1 joint report by the Homeland Security Policy Institute at America's George Washington University and the Swedish National Defense College. Now, others are diehard militants seeking mortal combat and martyrdom against non-Muslim militaries, it said. Now, while hard numbers on the flow of foreign fighters to conflict zones were kept secret by Western spy agencies, it was evident that the threat from foreign fighters is now quickly growing in size and prominence, the report said. The September 10 report by U.S. terrorism experts Bruce Hoffman and Peter Bergen for the Bipartisan Policy Center said the threat from an al-Qaeda has grown more complex, and U.S. citizens and residents were playing an increasing role in the leadership of al-Qaeda planning and operations. The group's ability to carry out a major attack like that of September 11 was far less formidable than it was in 2001. But the group might be able to bomb symbolic American targets, such as the subways of Manhattan, in attacks that killed dozens. The level of threat is likely to persist for years to come, it said. All right, now, folks, this is something we really got to think about here. This is going to be a problem. And the problem here, you got to define the problem. The problem is that you have got people who have been born in Germany, in France, in Britain, and sometimes here in the USA, who are willing to go over and become terrorists. Now, what would drive somebody to do something like this? Well, let me ask you something. What drives rich kids to become liberals to begin with? All right? Now, you might think that the two are completely unrelated, but I don't think so. I really believe that the two are, you know, the people who from these countries, and like the article says, they're often well-to-do people. They're not exactly poor people. You know, these are people from, you know, some of the better classes of society, if you want to use the term classes, which I detest. But, you know, just to get the gist of what I'm saying here. You know, what is it that drives people to become liberals? And I believe it's the same motivations that drive people to become liberals here also drive these people to become Islamic terrorists elsewhere. You know, now, as was mentioned in the article here, the seeking of adventure, you know, could it be that they're bored with their money? Or could it be that somebody somewhere came along and made them feel guilty for the riches that they are walking into? And it doesn't have to be riches. You ain't going to be Rockefeller rich to feel this way. You know, and this is why your liberals end up where they are. Why liberals pervade the colleges of this country so much. I mean, there's generally, you know, people with money who end up in colleges, you know, more than anything else. And what happens to them? They get in there and they end up becoming indoctrinated. And one of the biggest means of this indoctrination is always to make them feel guilty for what they got. You know, how'd you come by that? You know, did your parents exploit poor people to do this? Do you understand that it's the exploitation of the common people that causes these people to become rich to begin with? Now, what are you going to do? You know, and a lot of people will strike out. A, they are bored, as you know, a lot of people say out there. Boredom's definitely got a lot to do with it, you know, because they got nothing better to do. They don't have that need to get the hell out there and go to work to just support themselves, support their families. You know, they don't have materialistic desires. Why, of course, look at it this way. They're taught that pure materialism is evil in itself, you know, which I think is always going to be a hoax. I mean, look at some of the definitions they give you for being materialistic, you know, putting materials over human concerns. Well, if you are human and there are materials that you want out of life, materialism is a human concern now, isn't it? Yep. Maybe right. There's always the other one there, too. Bush did it. You got to hand it to George Bush. But there's no doubt about the fact that that is one of the groups that these kind of people are going to prey on. You know, make no mistake about it. They will prey on these, you know, upper middle class, you know, lower upper class kind of kids, you know, who walk into money, who really have nothing else better to do in life. Parents indulge them, let them have whatever they want. And where do they end up, you know, if they're not, you know, marching with Code Pink or Answer or some of the other miscreants that were down in Washington there on 10-2-10. Just something I'm not going to get around here too much. It was obviously an insignificant event, not worth commenting on. But this is where they end up, you know, where they end up over on Facebook, posting all sorts of anti-American comments over there. or other places. I mean, this is what you see. So, but like they say, it's a growing threat. Because here's a chance for real adventure. Here's a chance to really lay your life on the line. Head on over there. If you're going to be one of those kind of people that has always ever just done something halfway or never really felt the real joy or the real, you know, thrill of actual fear, you know, the rednecks like us find at speeds of 100 mile an hour plus on motorcycles or cars or out hunting or out fishing or out doing any other damn thing in the wild, you know, they're going to go look for their adventure in other places, which I believe is actually in every human soul. Now, there are always going to be those out there who fear adventure so bad that they won't move outside of their own house or outside of their own jobs or do whatever it is, you know, blah, 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 blah. I don't want to do that. I'm afraid. I'd be afraid to take a trip up to there. I'd be afraid to go there. I'm not going to do that. I mean, you're always going to hear that group. No mistake about it. You know, but you hear the group out there all of a sudden says, I'm not going to be afraid anymore. This is what I'm going to do. And bang, off they go. Let's go join Al-Qaeda. You know, this is a dangerous kind of thing. You know, idle Europeans heading over there. Yep, obviously something we got to look at for years to come. And obviously why we need to keep up what we're doing in the Middle East. You know, it's I'm still hearing people out there telling me in some of these chat rooms, oh, you know, look at all the money that Bush wasted on these useless wars. Look, I'm here to tell you, folks, before we can end this, we're going to end up spending way, way, way more money, you know, retraining the people of the Middle East to live like human beings. And it's that simple, folks. You know, the statement that I've made 100 times before, and I'm going to make 100 times into the future. It's like this, folks. They are trying to teach us how to live, and they are trying to teach us how to live at the point of a gun. We either teach them how to live, or they will end up teaching us how to live. Cannot have it both ways, you know, and they are going to do it or die. It's that simple. So, hey, folks, you got to look at it the same way. Either we are going to do it or we are going to die. Make no mistake about it. This is the battle of our lives. right, this is the battle. And it's, you know, this is, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this is a battle of one civilization against another, you know, because that would be to justify their civilization as a civilization. No, this is a battle of the civilized of the world against the uncivilized. And that is the best way to put it. When the only way you can get other people to go along, which should be run, is at the point of a gun, you are acting in an uncivilized manner. If you cannot convince someone through the forces of logic and reason, you know, that your path is the best way to go, well, you must have the wrong path. You must have a bad path. It must be the just, I'm sorry, but it's not the way to go, you know. And when you democratically take a people out there and tell them, well, the best thing you can Americans to do is everybody to point guns at everybody else and make them cough up their hard-earned money. Now, I'm sorry, folks, but that is no longer a civilized way of living life. At any rate, civilization right now demands that I go to a break here. We are at the bottom of the hour. And time for you folks to do something real civilized, like go over to HearnCode.com and find some of the nice things at Bob's gift shop and buy them up. All right, folks, you're listening to HearnCode. You're listening to the PoliticsCaf.com, the best in internet talk radio. Boy, I got to get some coffee here. We'll be right back, folks.
This next question is for Caroline. Caroline, if you take the bus 60 miles to school at 5:30 a.m. and the bus is traveling at an average of 30 miles per hour, how are you going to get to your prenatal appointment and still make it to homeroom on time?
Some students are tackling more than just their schoolwork, which is why more than 30% of them aren't graduating. But you can give them the boost they need to make it through by visiting boostup.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
Have you ever dreamed of being a karate master? Well, stop dreaming and start chopping with the Karate Glove.
Hi, my name's Molly, inventor of the Karate Glove, and I have just 1.5 words for you. Hi-ya!
The Karate Glove chops through anything. Just put it on and instantly chop through wood. Hi-ya! Concrete. Hi-ya! Brick walls. Hi-ya! Trees. Hi-ya! Small cars. It can even chop through these 8 guitars.
Hi-ya!
It chops things.
If I can invent a karate glove, just imagine what you can do. Visit inventnow.org to get started on your invention. Anything's possible. Keep thinking.
Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
It's hi-ya time!
I wasn't going to school because I was just making money stealing cars. And one day, I was put into juvie for 2 stolen cars, robbery of a house, and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon.
Well, I was 10 when I first got involved with drugs. I skipped school because, you know, nobody cared. I mean, I was on drugs, and my mom didn't really care because she was on drugs. She was never home.
When I first got pregnant, school was not important to me, so I dropped out. And now that I'm 15, I have 2 babies.
I was heading nowhere. I just thought, the only way I can make something out of my life is that if I get an education. One day I was locked up. That's when I really realized that, I mean, it wasn't for me. Like, I was only in there 2 months, but to me that was enough. It'd be better for me to stay in school, just get my education.
I still need to go to school to make it for myself. Stay in school. Give yourself a chance.
I think I'm happier now. I know I'm happier now.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
And we're back. Hey, buddy, we didn't mean to cut you off the mic there right now, but the show came back on here. And geez, we didn't want you advertising everything out there to all them fine listeners. But hey, don't go away. That was not anything done out of malice. All right, folks, you're listening to the Politics Cafe, and we are back. This is unbelievable. This one here is on healthcare tonight, and it came down off of CQ Politics. It's now this is just some of the ramifications that you're going to see running into here coming down the road. And it's liberals are probably going to agree with this. I am not. All right, and for several reasons that I'll give you after this, okay? The article here is Senator presses for information from health insurer used by McDonald's. Senator John D. Rockefeller IV is seeking more information about the health insurance policy sold to nearly 30,000 employees at McDonald's restaurants after a report suggested that the company might drop the coverage unless regulators waived a requirement in the health care law. A Rockefeller, Democrat of West Virginia, asked BCS Financial Corporation, which provides insurance to hourly wage McDonald's employees, for details about its coverage plans by October the 15th. He expressed concern the employers may be setting aside portions of their paychecks for an insurance product that may not be providing them a good value. The letter follows a Wall Street Journal story that reported that McDonald's told the Obama administration that its insurer cannot meet a provision in the law that goes into effect in 2011 and requires plans to spend 80% to 85% of their customers' premiums dollars on health care benefits. The story was denied by McDonald's and the administration. If the information in the story is correct, your company is apparently spending a significantly lower percentage of McDonald's employees' health care premiums on their medical care than required under law, Rockefeller said in an October 1 letter to Scott Beecham, president and CBO of BCS Financial. The $2,000 maximum annual coverage offered by the basic plan offered McDonald's hourly workers is unlikely to cover the cost of a medical emergency or delivery of a child, Rockefeller added. McDonald's provides mini-med plans for workers at 10,500 U.S. locations. A single worker can pay $14 a week for a plan that caps annual benefits at $2,000, or about $32 a week to get coverage up to $10,000 a year. Now, in a statement September 30th, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius called the suggestion that McDonald's workers might lose their health coverage because of the law flat out wrong. Similar denials were issued by Steve Russell, Senior Vice President and Chief People Officer at McDonald's. Rockefeller has touted the requirement, known as the medical loss ratio, as one of the overhaul's most important consumer protections. Now, this, folks, is not a consumer protection. Now, to look at this on the surface of this, you're basically saying, well, geez, it should be right that and you can just hear a lefty saying this. Well, it should be right that, you know, they're spending 80 to 85% on their employees. I mean, what are they doing with the rest of it? That has to be profit. You know, of course, evil profits coming into account here. But I want you to stop and think about something here, okay? You're getting $10,000 worth of year for coverage for $32 a week. All right, it's $120 a month. It's about $1,100 a year, so you're paying. 12, maybe 13. All right, excuse me? Where else are you going to get $10,000 worth of coverage for that kind of money? All right, nowhere. All right, if you look at that on the surface of it, it's pretty damn cheap. You know, I never worked at a place that was less than $65 or $75 a week, you know, for a small plan, you know, for just myself. And, you know, let's stop and face this here. Look at what you're looking at. And why is it so cheap for McDonald's workers? Well, stop and think about your typical McDonald's worker. Generally a teenager or somebody into their early 20s. Okay, and don't forget, they're giving this to the hourly paid people. They're not talking about what the managers and the assistant managers and the district reps and all the rest of them get. All right, I'm sure that's going to be a much healthier plan. All right, probably costs a lot more money, too, if you stop and think about it. But the average person working in there has little to no need whatsoever of health insurance. All right, and on top of that, you're working for McDonald's. All right, look, any other thing that could possibly happen to you would probably happen at McDonald's and would be covered by workman's compensation insurance, which I am sure they carry and which is not mentioned anywhere at all in this article. So, you know, I'm here to tell you that this is crap, okay? And the biggest part of this crap here is this portion of the law that says that any company's got to go to 85%. Of whatever it is they're taking in. Now, the implication here, all right, is that a company that is charging more than that in order to stay in business will have to bring their premiums down to reflect that they are now spending 85% of whatever it is they're taking in back out in premiums. Well, to me, that seems awful goddamn risky for any insurance company to try to work on such a slim margin. You know, because that's not always a profit margin. That is money that you have to set aside just in case something happens that is going to drive up, you know, the amount of claims. And this does happen. I mean, look at the goddamn colds that just came all through over here. You know, this one that I've been fighting back and forth here for the past 2 or 3 weeks. you know, honestly, I haven't used any of my health care benefits yet because I think I'm going to fight it myself, but I have been at it for 3 weeks. If I don't get rid of it in another week, I'm going to end up having to go to the doctor to do something about it. But, you know, the point is, you just don't know. You know, you have no idea. Now, health insurance companies in the past have run into this, and they formulated positions, you know, to insulate themselves from having to go out of business. But to sit down and tell them going to have to reflect that 85% of it is going back in, I'm sorry. But there is no insurance company in hell that is going to sit there and look at this and say, well, yeah, we should be able to stay in business at that rate. So, what does this get back to? Zach's healthcare bill on the air in January before the damn thing got signed. All right, this is nothing more than an attempt to drive the smaller private insurers out of business. Period, blank, end of statement. That's all this is. The 4 or 5 big insurance companies, which think they're really going to be around a few years for all of the people in this country, you know, after they've gotten everyone forced into doing business with them at the point of a gun. 16,000 extra IRS agents that have been hired to make sure that health care goes into effect on everybody. Yeah, well, after that happens, trust me, these big insurance companies are going to get absorbed by the government, too. Maybe there's some of them that know this. Who knows? But the fact of the matter is, that's where it's headed. And this is nothing more than an attempt to drive these little guys out, thereby solidifying the monopolization that is being pulled off with this health care law. You know? Make no mistake about it. Monopolies in business do not exist without government help. They cannot exist without government help. It's that simple. You know, any way you look at it. You know, if there is no government help going on there, then there probably is not a monopoly. And I would point this right back to the people out there saying, oh, Bill Gates had a monopoly on Microsoft. He had a monopoly on computers. Well, no, he didn't either, huh? Because how many of you people out there own Apples? How many of you are listening to me right now on an Apple Macintosh or Apple, some other product? You know? I'm sure there's quite a few of you out there, okay? How many more people out there are listening to me on freeware? All right, we all know what freeware I'm talking about, Linux. All right, there are many, many people who are involved in Linux, many people who get Red Hat Linux, many people who understand that Linux is an open source sort of thing. It was developed by a community of people over, you know, quite a few years here. It keeps on being developed. It's always in development with people looking at it, and is available free to anybody anywhere. All right, so guess what? Microsoft never had a monopoly. All that Microsoft has with the best damn product that you could buy for the purposes that you were looking for, and that's why everybody, or most everybody, went to it. You couldn't blame them. That's why most of the retailers went that way and carried Microsoft products. You couldn't blame them at all. For the diversity, for the ease of use, for you know, for the power, for everything that you got from Microsoft products, come on, well worth this, the $60 or $90 or $99, whatever it was that you spent it on. You know, even for those people that went out there and bought the Ultimate. And, Christ, I'm already 2 steps back here. I'm still running XP on this. I can't even remember the name of the last one because we've got a Windows 7 out there now. But even the point of the matter is, you know, monopolies do not happen without government help. They can't, you know. That's how monopolies were formed by insurance companies in lots of states around this union. You know, that's how Blue Cross and Blue Shield managed to gain their first monopoly way back when, in 1964. You know, when they got the government to declare them as a non-profit organization. You know, and who was it that started Blue Cross and Blue Shield? Well, who is it that starts a lot of these insurance companies today? People in the healthcare business, doctors who understand, hey, you know, why should I make money being a doctor and take all them chances with people's lives when I can make more money in the insurance business? You know, now, of course, you're going to get into the insurance business. You've got to provide a good product at a good cost. You know, you got to be competitive. You got to be able to compete with other people, which, you know, hey, look, that's the way it works. That's the way America works. All right, now, talking about competition and stuff, I do have to dig around in here a little bit because buried somewhere in a stack of stuff, we got an article here on what is going on with credit cards. Evidently, three of the largest credit card producers out there are, let me see here, I know I've got this somewhere deep buried in all of this. Let me take a peek. Looking around. Yeah, it's going to come up here, folks. Just bear with me one second. We have the credit card company. The federal government evidently took Visa, MasterCard, and American Express to court and sued them over anti-competitive practices. Visa and MasterCard, very, very quick to settle this out of court. Didn't want to deal with it for whatever. However, American Express has turned around and told them that they are ready to take all the time in the world to fight this, and don't care. You know what they say, that what the federal government is doing is wrong here. And come on, Marco, where the hell did you hide this this article? Oh, my goodness. I'll tell you what, folks. Sometimes it just isn't easy to be me through the stack of stuff here. But it's like I say here. Now, I'm sorry, but MasterCard and Visa, they are tied in with all of the biggest banks in this country. They have always been. Hey, look at your bank card, okay? If you have, a card that allows access to your checking account, or a card that allows access to your savings account, or what have you, your debit card, you know, your bank card, what's it say in the corner of it? MasterCard and Visa. All right, let's face it, they have been tied in, all right, with the banks for a long, 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 long time. Now, a lot of this had to do with, and I know eventually here I am going to find this, folks. I am searching diligently. That it's a, let me see, maybe it's over on the Reuters here that we keep it. Nope. No, I don't want to get into that one there. All right, and I may end up having to get back to that one. At any rate, it's I'm sure at some point here it's going to gather up, and we will find it. Now, of course, on back of all this, let me I got to get into this one here that I got the stack of stuff's kind of waiting on the side here. You want to hear some crap? This is as deep as the crap gets. Everybody, get your hip boots out, pull them on, pull them up high. If you got chest waders, you're even better. President Barack Obama's $814 billion stimulus plan is meeting its targets for spending and job creation, White House officials said on Friday, however unpopular it may be with the public. Right. Now, I challenge this person here, Patricia Zingerle, to go back and please tell us what were those targets. And would you please show us in any of Obama's speeches, or in any of the speeches given by Larry Summers, or any of the rest of the Klan there, Timothy Geithner, exactly what those targets were that they have met? Now, 70% of the plan's funds were paid out by September 30th, with $308 billion spent and $243 billion in tax breaks provided, it claims. They said, adding that every spending deadline Congress set for the funds was met on time or ahead of schedule with little fraud or abuse. Well, you know, I don't remember seeing any spending timelines in the bill, you know. I don't understand how that worked out. Polls have shown that the plan is unpopular with much of the public and has fallen short of expectations for the economy. Even though the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates, and this is an estimate, it boosted real gross domestic product in the second quarter by up to 4.5% and raised employment by up to 3.3 million jobs. All the while, we're losing 600,000 jobs a month. Somehow or another, this raised employment by up to 3.3 million jobs. Right. Jared Bernstein, chief economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, in other words, his major bullshitter, and former White House economist Christina Romer, wrote a paper in early 2009 contending that the stimulus would cap the jobless rate at 8%. Well, I guess that was wrong, wasn't it? So where's that target met? With the unemployment rate at 9.6% in August and expecting to have inched up to 9.7% in September, data will be released next week, that paper has given Republicans a powerful weapon to argue that the Recovery Act has failed. Yes, it has. The administration predicted that unemployment wouldn't rise above 8% if the $1 trillion stimulus became law, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said. We know how that turned out. Unemployment, now at 9.6%, has hovered near double digits since the stimulus passed. We took on an additional $1 trillion in debt, and Americans' confidence in the administration's economic arguments never recovered. The administration contends that the nation would have been far worse without the plan, given the dire state of the U.S. economy when Obama took office in early 2009. No piece of legislation would have been capable of filling that hole, White House spokesman Robert Gibbs said. bullshit. However, the concept has proven difficult to sell to the public, and Republicans in the House of Representatives recently vowed to cancel all unspent money from the economic stimulus plan. Well, hooray for them. Republicans are expected to cut into Democratic majorities in the House and Senate in next month's congressional elections, although Democrats have been heartened by a modest boost in their national poll numbers, as Obama administration officials turned up their attacks on Republican economic policies. Administration officials said on Friday that very little stimulus money, a few billion dollars, depending on how it's calculated, was actually free to be spent. Much of the $233 billion that remains in the fund has been promised but not yet formally spent, and part of it is in tax relief, they said. Right. Ed Deceive, Obama's senior advisor for Recovery Act implementation, said his only concern about the act was the failure to communicate. If we were disappointed with anything, it's our inability to really get the message out exactly the way the American people want to hear it, he said. Now, you failed to get the message out so that the American people bought your crap. That's the problem. You're going to sit here and tell us that the American people want to hear what? They want to hear you doing good. Well, you've been saying you've been doing good, but we haven't been seeing it. All right, that's what's going on here, you dummy. It's that simple. I'm sorry, Ed Deceive, but you got that one wrong. You know, Mr. Obama, you know, the smart move here, my friend, would be for you to go back to the person who taught you how to do all this. And I still say that George Lakoff, who was fired by the DNC in September of 2008 prior to the elections there, but was the one that trained Obama. You know, Obama must have read his books, did exactly what Mr. Lakoff said in there, learned to use the correct buzzwords, hope, change, hope we can count on, change you can hope for, all those good words to get himself elected. Well, if he wants to keep it moving, this is what he's going to have to do. Now, would the economy have really felt a lot worse without it? Maybe. But what's the point here? You know, the fact of the matter is, at some point in time, the debt is going to come due. Okay? The day of reckoning is on its way. Borrowing money to put off the day of reckoning is still doing nothing more than putting off the day of reckoning. And the more you borrow against putting off that day of reckoning, okay, the worse that day of reckoning is going to be when it finally hits the fan. You know, it can't be put any simpler than that. You know, the one thing that you want to, you know, figure out that when you're in a hole, you stop digging. You know, that's where you have got to be. Now, political commentary on tonight here. Obviously, I'm going to open this up. If anybody out there has anything they'd like to add, please feel free to raise your hand. But in the dawn here, before these elections come about in the next couple of weeks, I know a lot of people are feeling really hopeful out there that things are going to turn around, that the Republicans are going to take over Congress, and things are going to get a whole lot better. Well, I'm going to be honest with you folks, I don't see that happening right away. I really don't. And if they pass themselves a tax cut bill that will look permanent, okay, that won't have a sunset clause in it, that won't revoke everything that George Bush did, or at least gave some permanency to the situation, even if they were to raise taxes but say that's it, you can do it no more, you know, whatever it is, that is about the only thing that is going to turn this economy around. People have got to understand that businesses work on long range expectations. Okay, when you get into a business, all right, and you are looking for what it is that you're going to do down the road, if you're going to have a successful business, you are going to plan. You know, it's that simple. You have got to have a plan that is going to take up not only what you're doing a year from now or 5 years from now or even 10 years from now. You've got to be able to look at 30 years down the road, because you may be borrowing money, okay, or you may be taking an investor's money who's going to be into it for that long. All right? An investor, unless, you know, he's looking at a long-range plan, isn't going to invest any money with you. You know, not a private investor. Now, of course, you can always go get the Small Business Administration loans out there, you know, put up your house, put up your real estate, put up everything you own against it. You know, what's in the end, what are you doing here? Oh, you're just remortgaging everything, period. You know what I mean? They are not making an investment in you. They are giving you a loan against real estate and real goods and real tangible things that you have. All right, it's that simple. I've been looking at the small business loans out there, and the more I look at them, the more of a farce they are. If you have a viable business, you should be able to look to any business investment house that would be willing to do business with you and come in and invest. All right, they're not going to invest with you if they see a losing situation, and they've seen enough of them in the past that they have the experience. All right, they will be able to guide you and advise you along the way. You will either be taking their guidance and their advice, or they will be telling you no. You know, they will either look at you and say, yes, you are doing the kind of things that we have seen in the past that have proven to be highly successful. How much do you need? Or they'll be able to look at you and say, well, you know, you're doing this and this and this, and everybody we've ever seen do that is going to fail. So, no, we're not going to invest in you under those terms. All right? Because we don't want to lose along with you. You know? But the fact of the matter is, when you have a government in flux, when you don't know what the hell that government is going to do next week, next month, next year, next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the road, no investor in hell is going to look at you and your business. You know, he is not going to look at any business whatsoever because he doesn't know what's going to happen to him. He doesn't know whether the government's going to come in and take over his investment. He doesn't know if he's going to be holding shares of stock in a company that the government will end up co-opting, you know, a.k.a. GM, Chrysler, and a few others out there. Stop and think about this, you know. Look at everything they just did to all the financial institutions out there with what that just happened, you know, over the last few weeks here. All right? And look at, on top of that, all the banks that are getting ready to fail right now because of that. Well, that's probably another story. But, folks, you're getting the drift of what I'm saying here. You know, if these Republicans that take over here do something on a permanent basis, if they get in there and say, look, this is where taxes need to be in order to solve the country's problems, but we're going to set them there and we're going to carve them in stone, and that is where they will be for as long as we could possibly see out to the future, and put something in there that doesn't have a sunset on it, something that people can count on, then you may see a return to investment in this country. Then you will see job creation going on. Then you will see this economy start to recover. But unless we have a government that's going to look as rock solid, okay, as it possibly can, forget it, you know. And personally, to be honest with you, Republicans' past performance, I just don't see that coming, you know. Kind of scares the shit out of me when I look at them that way. It really does, because it's like, you know, we really expected this to come out of them when we elected them in 2000, you know. It even more so when we brought them back again in 2004, you know. They cried fiscal responsibility. They cried this. Well, you know, they cried tax cuts. Yes, they gave us tax cuts. Thank you very much. They were very nice. Really helped the economy move along here. Really helped investment happen. Really helped everybody have a better life. Brought real wages up to highs that were never seen before. You know, brought the standard of living up. Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, when you're looking at a government in flux, you can't do that. And nobody is willing to go out on a limb with that. You know, and that is despite that everything Obama is trying to do with the tax situation out there right now. Because he can't. I mean, let's face it, he's just not going to be able to pull it off. You know, he can't sit there and tell people, oh, you know, you're going to get 100% deduction on any capital investments that you make in your business. You know, you won't have to worry about taking out, you buy a new piece of equipment, you won't have to worry about depreciating it over 5 or 10 years or whatever its expected life is. You can take it all right away. Well, that doesn't mean a damn thing if you're going to turn around and raise his corporate income taxes, you know, 2, 5, 10%. You know, why is he still going to bother? And the worst part about it is he knows damn well that you're spending money like it's going out of tubes and you're going to have to raise his taxes again. Why would he do that? You know, what is the biggest point in there? Ah, here we are, folks. I knew that some point in time I would get back and I would find this. Thank you very much. Here it is. This is by Pete Yost off the AP. The Justice Department today sued the three largest U.S. credit card companies for anti-competitive practices and reached a proposed settlement with two of them, MasterCard and Visa. We want to put more money in consumers' pockets, and by eliminating credit card companies' anti-competitive rules, we will accomplish exactly that, Attorney General Eric Holder told an afternoon news conference. The companies put merchants and their customers in a no-win situation, and consumers are being held hostage. Now, it doesn't quite say how. This is the interesting part of this. American Express Company said it is willing to wage a multi-year fight against the federal lawsuit, arguing that the Justice Department's proposed remedy would promote steering customers from one payment network to another and will do nothing to enhance competition. In papers filed in federal court in Brooklyn, the department and various state attorney generals sued all three companies, saying they were attempting to insulate themselves from competition. At the same time, the Justice Department filed a settlement it has reached with Visa and MasterCard. Court approvals of such settlements is usually a formality. Now stop and think about this, folks. This has got Elliot Spitzer written all over it. You know, they filed suit today in Brooklyn, okay? And at the same time, it says it right here in this article, at the same time, the Justice Department filed a settlement it has reached with Visa and MasterCard. You know? Now, is this a shakedown or is this a shakedown? I mean, I'm sorry, but it's got the smell of Elliot Spitzer all over it. At the same time, under the settlement, Visa and MasterCard agree not to prohibit merchants from offering customers discounts or rebates for using a particular kind of card. Now, Visa and MasterCard also must allow merchants to express preferences for the use of a low-cost card within a network or other form of payment. The lawsuit says the card companies are impeding merchants from promoting the use of competing credit or charge cards with lower acceptance fees. Each time consumers use a credit card to make a purchase, the merchant must pay a fee. Such fees brought in $35 billion last year to the three credit card companies and their affiliated banks. Now, we're partway there with a proposed settlement with Visa and MasterCard, Assistant Attorney General Christine Varney, head of the department's antitrust division, told the news conference. We remain open to seek a settlement with American Express, Varney added. Yeah, right. Shares of American Express closed at $39.05, down more than 6%. MasterCard ended at down less than 1 percentage point, and Visa was down for the day at 73.24, losing less than a quarter percentage point. Joining the lawsuit were state attorney generals from Maryland, Connecticut, Iowa, Michigan, Missouri, Ohio, and Texas. Now, American Express maintained that its agreements with merchants protect its cardholders, who tend to be more affluent and spend more than other card users. Moreover, the company said many of its merchant contracts do allow promotions. In effect, the government is arguing that we cannot freely negotiate with our merchants about how they treat our card members at the point of sale, said Amex Journey General Counsel Louise Parent. She said the contracts are intended to shield consumers from pressure by merchants not to use the cards of their choice. Now, this is unbelievable. You know, has anybody ever gone into a store and say, hey, use MasterCard instead of Visa, it'll cost you 2% less. Hey, use your American Express, it'll cost you 3% less. Has anyone out there ever seen that? Has anyone ever been directed to use one card or another by any merchant anywhere at all? Now, there's merchants out there that tell you they don't take a card. You know, more often than not, you will hear it. We don't take American Express, MasterCard, Visa only. You know, stop about it. Yeah, sure, they do. That's right, exactly. It's the way it works there, Shanika. You're right. You know, merchants do pay this. And American Express doesn't care. You know, American Express knows which of their consumers, because it is, you know, let's face it, it's their higher earners. They're people who have more money that got an American Express card. American Express is not a charge card, or not a credit card, it's a charge card. All right, whatever you charge on that card 1 month, you've got to pay off the next month. You can't just, you know, you can run it up to whatever the hell you want, you know, but if you don't pay it next month, bang, that card's good as, you know, good to pick a lock with, that's about it. You know, but the fact of the matter is, they got no business in there doing this. Now, like I say, this is nothing more than a huge, huge, huge shakedown, you know. And I know there's going to be more of this coming out, because it just went too simple, too stupid, and ran by everybody's noses. I'm sorry, but for a lawsuit to be filed in Brooklyn on, you know, in the middle of the day, and at the exact same time a settlement to be reached in Washington, there's something stinky going on there, folks. Something real stinky. At any rate, something real stinky going to happen here. If I don't close up the shop, the major interests are gone. Once again, the chairs are all piled high on top of the tables. The place is swept clean and the lights are dim. So it's time to close up the cafe, folks. And I have got the blast. I got to head right out of here. Got a little bit of a driving to do tonight. But we will see you later. Folks, you have listened to the Politics Cafe at www.herncode.com, the best in internet talk radio. All right, folks. Good night. We'll see y'all later on.